maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
The FLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalize their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
EU foreign affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2%, with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had 5 stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable, regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbas is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical remarks and threat of sanctions against Moscow. The Kremlin accuses Ukraine and the West of violating the Minsk agreements. It says the government in Kyiv is committing genocide in the Donbas region, while the West sends offensive weapons to the country. On the other hand, the West claims Russia intends to invade Ukraine. The Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 to secure a ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian forces in the east of Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly expressed concern about NATO's eastward expansion, demanding a ban on Ukraine's admission to the military alliance. So far, the U.S. and its NATO allies have only blown on calls by ignoring Russia's concerns and its requests for security guarantees.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the bold escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the crisis escalates between Russia and Ukraine, it's the role of the media that's become increasingly crucial. In Britain's parliament, the leader of the opposition Labour Party waded into the discussion with a controversial position.
Russia today is his personal propaganda tool.
Yeah.
I can see no reason why it should be allowed to continue to broadcast in this country. So will the Prime Minister now ask Ofcom to review its licence?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, has already asked Ofcom to review that matter.
It's not the first time RT has been targeted. But long gone are the days of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn appearing on the channel. Starmer is keen to stake his anti-Russian credentials.
Russia and the West are both acutely aware that the media battle is as important as any armed conflict. And by attempting to silence Russian media here in the United Kingdom, the British establishment is simply continuing a long-held tradition of censorship.
Political observers disagree with Starmer's stance.
It's totalitarian surveillance capitalism, essentially, which is continuing its ugly march through the West. I mean, where we actually prided ourselves in not being so censored, we're now at the stage where we're controlling media. At that point, of course, I know Press TV were victims of exactly this. There have been many people across social media who are constantly being censored. And I think it's a very dangerous development. And when it's normalised to the extent where, you know, the major party leaders, the prime minister, are all acting as if it's a perfectly normal thing to do, it's a very dangerous and dark day for democracy.
Though it's not publicly commented on whether there will be a probe, Ofcom's impartiality has already come under scrutiny, and observers are urging caution and for the organisation to abide by media rules, not political pressure.
It is always good to hear the other side of an argument anyway and an alternative narrative so you can see and make a balanced judgment of what is going on, because we know from the Iraq war and the propaganda about WMD that our own government doesn't necessarily tell the truth when it goes to broadcast either. These are very troubled times, and the last thing we need is censorship of our television viewing.
As calls ring out for calm heads and a de-escalation to prevail in the current crisis, media observers hope the people at home and abroad can have a plurality of media voices, this to help shape their views. Amina Taylor, London.
In the limelight.
Pfizer is among the big pharma companies trying to block legislation strengthening whistleblowers' ability to report corporate fraud. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Li Feng, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Pfizer is lobbying to thwart whistleblowers from exposing corporate fraud. Stay tuned for more. Pfizer and other large pharmaceutical corporations are pushing to block legislation that would make it easier for whistleblowers to hold companies liable for corporate fraud. In the midst of a dizzying legislative environment, with much attention focused on the Build Back Better debate, major corporate interests, including Pfizer, are fighting an update to the False Claims Act, a Civil War-era law that rewards whistleblowers for filing anti-fraud lawsuits against contractors on behalf of the government. The law has historically returned $67 billion to the government, with whistleblowers successfully helping uncover wrongdoing by military contractors, banks, and pharmaceutical companies. The law has been particularly thorny for Pfizer. In 2009, Pfizer paid $2.3 billion in criminal and civil fines to settle allegations that the company illegally marketed several drugs for off-label purposes that were specifically not approved by the Food and Drugs Administration. The company instructed its marketing team to advertise Bixtra, which was approved only for arthritis and menstrual cramps for acute and surgical pain issues. The lawsuit brought under the False Claims Act through the actions of six whistleblowers ended in one of the largest healthcare fraud settlements in history. But the law poses far less risk today to companies engaged in criminal behavior. That's because the anti-fraud statute has been severely hampered by a series of federal court decisions that radically expanded the scope of what's known as materiality. In 2016, the Supreme Court ruled in Universal Health Services v. United States ex rel. Escobar that a fraud lawsuit could be dismissed if the government continued to pay the contractor. The court reasoned that if the government continues to pay a company despite fraudulent activity, then the fraud is not material to the contract. That ruling functionally neutered application of the False Claims Act against many companies that are so large that the government cannot abruptly sever payments, especially against large healthcare interests and defense contractors. Recent court decisions, including cases involving Honeywell and Halliburton, show contractors winning dismissal of fraud by simply citing continued government payments. Last year, a federal district court dismissed the False Claims Act case against engineering company AECOM, brought by a whistleblower alleging widespread billing fraud for a $2 billion contract in Afghanistan. AECOM lawyers also cited the government's continued payments to the company. The lawsuit is now under appeal. What's more, the federal government has taken an active role in discouraging cases. In 2018, the Trump administration's Justice Department issued the Grandstone Memo, which encouraged the dismissal of more whistleblower-initiated suits under the False Claims Act. In October, Attorney General Merrick Garland officially rescinded the overly restrictive memo, a move widely seen as designed to promote greater False Claims Act enforcement. The erosion of the statute has brought together a bipartisan push led by Senator Chuck Grassley to update the law to give whistleblowers greater protection against potential industry retaliation and make it more difficult for companies charged with fraud to dismiss cases on procedural grounds. Earlier this year, as he introduced the legislation, Grassley took to the Senate floor to showcase images of scrapped multi-billion Afghanistan war contracts and examples of fraud cases that have escaped accountability because of the judicial constraints placed on the False Claims Act. Thundered the senator, defendants get away with scalping the taxpayers because some government bureaucrats failed to do their job. In many years of investigating the Department of Defense, it has taught me that a Pentagon bureaucrat is rarely motivated to recognize fraud. That's because the money doesn't come out of their pocket, he added. The legislation, the False Claims Amendments Act of 2021, adjusts the materiality standard to include instances in which the government made payments despite knowledge of fraud if other reasons exist for continuing the contract. The bill also expands the anti-retaliation protections of the law, which currently only cover current whistleblower employees of a company. The bill seeks to prevent an industry from blacklisting former whistleblowers seeking employment. That push has run into a buzzsaw of corporate opposition, some of it disclosed and some of it shrouded from public view. Pfizer hired Hazen Marshall, a former policy director for Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, to lobby on the issue, along with the law firm Williams & Jensen, a powerhouse that employs an array of former congressional staffers. Pfizer, which has cast itself as a hero in the fight against COVID-19 and trustworthy corporate citizen, did not respond to a request for comment. In an initial test vote, the bill was blocked. In August, Grassley proposed his False Claims Amendment Act as an amendment to the bipartisan infrastructure agreement in the Senate. The bill, however, never reached the floor for a vote because of an objection lodged on behalf of Senate Democrats. In October, the legislation again found a hearing. Senator Tom Cotton attempted to erase most of the bill in a Judiciary Committee meeting. The amendment Cotton proposed sought to strike all substantive lines of the bill except for the first title, which is simply the description of the legislation. During committee debate, Cotton argued that the Supreme Court made the right decision in the Escobar case on the continued payment standard for materiality. The legislation potentially could increase healthcare costs, the senator argued, echoing industry claims that litigation from the False Claims Act would force healthcare interests to raise prices. The American Hospital Association reportedly lobbied to delay a vote, but the bill eventually passed 15-7 out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with the support of Grassley and his main co-sponsor, Senator Patrick Lee. This is a very concerted lobbying effort that really took our supporters on Capitol Hill by surprise, said Stephen Kahn, a whistleblower attorney with the law firm Kahn and Colapino. Many of the companies engaged in the lobbying fight have chosen to conceal their efforts through undisclosed third-party groups such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has made the Grassley bill one of its primary targets for defeat. The chamber does not disclose its membership for which corporations direct its advocacy, but previous reporting suggests companies such as Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, and J.P. Morgan Chase, among others, have faced False Claims Act violations in the past. Other trade groups, including the American Hospital Association, the Healthcare Leadership Council, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and the American Bankers Association, have lobbied against the bill without disclosing the companies directing their actions. The known corporate interest lobbying on the Grassley bill include Pfizer, Amgen, AstraZeneca, Merck, and Genentech. These companies listed the legislation on lobbying disclosures. All five have paid nine-figure settlements over healthcare fraud brought to light through False Claims Act. Drug companies are notorious for paying kickbacks, giving benefits in exchange for a competitive advantage. Drug companies and healthcare firms are about 80% of the False Claims Act recoveries for a reason, said Khan. In the case of Pfizer's record settlement, whistleblowers charged that the company promoted Bextra for uses that were not approved by the FDA, placing patients at risk for heart attack and a stroke. The company allegedly paid doctors kickbacks for off-label uses. The False Claims Act, like other quintem laws, awards whistleblowers a portion of the money the government recovers from lawsuits. John Kopchinski, one of Pfizer's whistleblowers following the settlement, said, "The whole culture of Pfizer is driven by sales, and if you didn't sell drugs illegally, you were not seen as a team player." The Grassley Initiative is championed by a diverse array of watchdog groups over government waste. Taxpayers Against Fraud, the National Whistleblower Center, the Project on Government Oversight, and the Government Accountability Project are among the group officially supporting the update to the anti-fraud law. But advocates have expressed confusion over the involvement of several other supposed taxpayer protection organizations. Citizens Against Government Waste and Americans for Tax Reform, two conservative groups that do not disclose donor information, filed a letter to lawmakers urging them to vote down the Grassley measure. Despite Citizens Against Government Waste's official focus on fighting government waste, the very intent of the False Claims Act, the group's lobbying arm argued in a letter that the bill was not appropriate for inclusion in the infrastructure package because it is not related to traditional infrastructure, and the bill is not fully understood by the 95 senators who have not co-sponsored the legislation. Americans for Tax Reform similarly argued that the legislation had not received proper debate. Neither Citizens Against Government Waste nor Americans for Tax Reform responded to requests for comments, explaining why they have lobbied so aggressively against taxpayer protection legislation and whether any donor interests are involved.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The recent revelations about the Trojan Horse scandal, a hoax plan for so-called extremists to take over a number of British schools, highlight the issue of institutionalized Islamophobia in the UK, and now victims of the government-backed Islamophobic purge are calling for justice and a fresh, independent inquiry. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at the different aspects of this scandal, as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fuelled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajare, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Let's start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedbro. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed, they were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Masud Shajara, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario? Despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes, why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children, not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to converse and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. His expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing the schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter. And everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jumped on that bandwagon and demonized the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions, because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. Their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. When you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed miserably to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Shajada. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled, and this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, they just believed it. And of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
You know, children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme while the education budgets were creaking along and you know, not able to perform. So there was a lot of there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajada, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools. It also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm, and we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. The problem is this, that, you know, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. Every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button, and we forget about everything that has happened in past, and we're forgetting that we are living in this environment, and then we get letters from the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. We need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister or two. And I think, you know, Ivan knows this very well. I remember, Ivan, you raised that once in a meeting you were to one of the very senior police officers. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up, when the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up, not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such affairs, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best-known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America? Because it should have come from the British media. But unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic. And, you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organizations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. They got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. We have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. but maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim sure. community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajadeh, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. No, you know, they are promoting Islamophobia in many ways. The fact that this sort of a story doesn't break out, the fact that, you know, even when it breaks out, you know, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, you know, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been called for resignation. And you know, shrinking spaces, sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't. And you know, now it's even sort of Zionists speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Yvonne is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. The last conference, which was in January on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bully.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, also head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.